Are you interested in religious freedom? Are you interested in gay rights? Do you perceive that maybe there's a conflict between the two? Well, if you've been listening to what's been going on in Indiana and several other states, actually, you've heard about something called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or RFRA for short, R-F-R-A. I always have trouble with that acronym for some reason. At any rate, the conflicts between the two of these things and perhaps the relationship between this statute and the Free Exercise Clause or the Establishment Clause of the U.S. Constitution, those are all rather confusing issues. So I've invited my buddy, Doug McKechnie, to come here and explain it. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's all about RFRA.
Your weekly constitutional is hosted by Professor of Law Stuart Harris and underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier.
I remember the first time I heard about something called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or RFRA for short, R-F-R-A. Makes you sound kind of like Scooby-Doo when you say it out loud. And I've always been a little bit confused by it. Why exactly do we have an act, a federal statute, about religious freedom when we already have two constitutional provisions specifically about freedom of religion? And why did Congress, back in 1993 when RFRA was enacted, why did Congress feel it necessary to restore religious freedom? Why, in fact, have a number of states made their own RFRAs part of their own state law? It's all very, very confusing to me. And of course, it's been very much in the news lately, as there's at least been a perceived conflict between religious freedom being restored on the one hand and gay rights being protected on the other. So I decided I'd call up my First Amendment buddy, Doug McKechnie, and ask him to explain it to us.
Stuart, my name is Douglas McKechnie, and I'm an assistant professor.
Oh, stop, Doug. I know who the heck you are. How many times have you been on this show?
Oh, I'm losing count. I'm running out of fingers.
Yeah, me too. Okay, but you do have to tell, for the uninitiated, who are you?
I'm an assistant professor in the law department at the United States Air Force Academy.
At the United States Air Force Academy, which, as I've mentioned before, I never even realized had a law department until I realized you'd basically taken it over.
Well, I'm not sure my colleagues would agree with that.
Understood. Okay, you've got a standard disclaimer you've got to give, don't you, before we go on, because you're a government guy?
I am. My views are my own and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the United States Air Force, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. Well, Stuart, today we're going to talk about the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment. The Free Exercise Clause prohibits or limits the government's ability to burden the exercise of our religion. And it's in the First Amendment. It was part of the Bill of Rights, and it coexists with not only the freedom of speech in the First Amendment, but other really important constitutional liberties that we have, the Establishment Clause and other liberties.
Yeah, we should always start with the text, at least, when we talk about the Constitution. I believe the text is Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, that's the Establishment Clause, nor prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That's the part we're really focusing on today. Congress shall make no law prohibiting the free exercise of religion. And of course, this has been very much in the news lately because of all this Religious Freedom Restoration Act stuff that's been coming out of primarily Indiana, but a number of other states as well. And that's what we're aiming for. We want to talk about that issue. But before we get to that issue and to be able to understand that issue, we've got a lot of spade work to do, don't we?
We do. And I think we have to go back to understand the Free Exercise Clause and to understand the Religious Freedom Restoration Acts that are in the news recently. I think we have to go all the way back to the late 1800s.
Okay.
Not to necessarily look for the intent of the framers, because the framers of the First Amendment lived before the late 1800s, mm-hmm. but for the purposes of constitutional interpretation and the Supreme Court, that was the first time in the late 1800s, in a case called Reynolds versus the United States, that was the first time the Supreme Court articulated its interpretation of the Free Exercise Clause.
And that's kind of freaky to think about that, because that is a significant amount of time, almost a century really, since the Free Exercise Clause was adopted in 1791. And there's a reason for that, and without going into too much detail, basically when it was first written, the entire Bill of Rights, including the First Amendment, was widely interpreted to apply only to the federal government. And it did not apply. In fact, the court itself said that it did not apply to the state governments. And it was only after the Civil War and after the adoption of the 14th Amendment and its due process clause that bit by bit, the free exercise clause, along with the rest of the Bill of Rights, was applied to the states. And that's why, of course, today the First Amendment applies to both the states and the federal governments. But this was sort of in the twilight period before the First Amendment was specifically applied to the states, right?
It was, and indeed this was so long ago that the case that we're going to talk about in a moment that arises in the late 1800s came out of the Utah Territory. So at the time, Utah wasn't even a state, it was just a territory, and so as a result, the federal government could pass laws that would regulate actions within the Utah Territory.
Yes, and so that's why we're talking about the First Amendment. We're talking about it because this was a federal territory, so it was governed by the federal Constitution.
Correct.
That's so cool. I'm so cool. That's such a good explanation of why this was interpreted. Because, you know, as you know, the First Amendment wasn't incorporated against the states until the early 20th century. And so I think there's always been a question in the back of my mind, or at least it was before I read the Reynolds case, as to why this was the free exercise case or the first big one. But now I'm getting really geeky. Sorry about that. Go on.
We're probably going to geek out a lot during our conversation, as we often do.
All right.
But there was a federal law that prohibited bigamy. It was essentially a limitation on bigamy and a requirement that to the extent that you're going to enter into a marriage, it can only be with one other person. And that law conflicted with the Mormon faith of many people at the time, particularly in the Utah Territory. And so a gentleman challenged that law and said that this prohibition on bigamy, he wanted to engage in bigamy or multiple marriage. His argument was that the federal law against bigamy conflicted with his Mormon faith, and therefore he was prohibited from exercising his religion freely.
And that's how these cases typically arise. When you think of the free exercise of religion, when you think of the actual text of the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law infringing the free exercise of religion, then you start thinking about laws that actually say, you know, you can't be a Mormon, or a law saying you can't be a Catholic. Such laws did exist in our country early on, or effectively they did with various establishments of religion and persecution of religious minorities. But by the late 19th century, and certainly in the present day, such laws, if they exist at all, are very rare. So you very, very rarely get a law targeting a religion. What typically happens is you get this kind of law that seems to have nothing to do with religion to begin with. It's neutral. It's generally applicable. But then somebody raises his hand, like this fellow Reynolds, and says, wait a second, this law impacts my religious exercise.
That's right. This was the first time the Supreme Court was faced with this question. How, the Supreme Court asked itself, how are we going to interpret the free exercise clause of the First Amendment? What does it mean? And I think that's why it's important to start with this particular case, because the Supreme Court had to really think about what's guaranteed by the Free Exercise Clause. And so the Supreme Court looks back to the history, particularly of importance at the time. The Supreme Court was looking at some writings by Thomas Jefferson, and this is the first time that this idea of a wall of separation between church and state enters the lexicon of the Supreme Court, and probably even the lexicon of scholars who talk about what the religion clauses mean.
That phrase, of course, had been famously used, I think it was in 1801, wasn't it, with Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptist Association?
It was.
But you're pointing out that that was just Jefferson's phrase until the court adopted it in 1879.
They did, and what's interesting, and there's been a lot of criticism about it, is this was simply a letter from Jefferson responding to some criticism for not, as his predecessors had done, for not proclaiming a national day of fasting and Thanksgiving. He decided not to do that. He was concerned about the appearance that there was some sort of establishment of religion, and so he was responding to that criticism. That letter, literally just a letter, no legal text, not part of the Constitution, but that letter was incorporated into the Supreme Court's decision such that it sort of took on an appearance of legal significance.
Right. Well, that's the old adage. Once the Supreme Court says something in an opinion, it's pretty darn important.
It is.
And it can enter the law exactly that way. And I believe the Reynolds opinion was a unanimous opinion, too. It was 9-0. So it was very firmly established in Supreme Court precedent from 1879 on. But More to the point here, they also adopted the approach that essentially someone like Reynolds, well, let you tell it. What happened to Reynolds? Did he win?
He did not win. So the Supreme Court, in trying to figure out what exactly the free exercise clause means, thought, you know, clearly there's this distinction with our religious experience, for the individual's religious experience. There's a distinction between what one believes and how one manifests that belief, what one does to sort of further his or her religious belief. So the distinction between belief and action or conduct. And the Supreme Court ultimately said, you know, clearly Congress has no legislative power to try to enforce opinion, religious opinion or religious belief. But at the same time, Congress can regulate actions that it deems to be socially subversive or not in society's best interest. And so, sort of boiled down, the Supreme Court said, look, Congress can't enforce a religious dogma, belief, but it certainly can regulate our actions.
And if you have some religious objection, you're not entitled to an exception.
That's right.
And that's what Reynolds wanted. He said, basically wanted to say, I want to be exempted from this law. Sometimes we use the term in the modern parlance to be accommodated. I want my religious practices to be accommodated. I prefer to use the word exception because I think it's more common usage. Reynolds wanted an exception because he had a certain religious belief, and he didn't get it. The court basically said, nope, this bigamy statute is applies to everybody, just, and it applies to you like everybody else. Believe whatever you want, but you're going to have to obey the law when it comes to plural marriages.
Right. The Supreme Court said, if we let Reynolds or anyone say, hey, my religious belief is X and therefore I don't have to comply with the law, then that would allow religious beliefs to trump secular law. And the Supreme Court famously said that would permit every citizen to become a law unto himself. So religious beliefs would be superior to the law of the land. And the Supreme Court said we can't allow that.
I really kind of regret this decision, Doug, because I have a very deep-seated religious belief that I should not have to pay taxes. Now, that's not general. I don't believe that you should be exempted from taxes. In fact, I think you should pay more. In fact, I think I also should be entitled to more government benefits. So I want an exception from the tax laws because I am the First Church of Stuart Harris.
Well, I would consider joining that church, Stuart.
I would let you.
If I can get out of paying taxes, I certainly might consider it. But I think that's exactly what the Supreme Court was concerned about. You know, you get arrested for jaywalking and you say, well, you know, that law, that conflicts with my religious belief. My religious belief compels me to jaywalk. It compels me to speed. My religious belief compels me to take in illegal drugs, whatever it is. The Supreme Court was concerned about that any religious belief, truly held or otherwise, would allow you to avoid either the compulsion that a law may require, so a required action, or a prohibition on action.
And that would be a problem.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we're speaking about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or RFRA, actually about more than one of them, because they've been enacted all across the United States lately. After the break, we won't have our constitutional quiz, both because Doug Smith and I at Montpelier need to record a few extra, and because I don't really want to interrupt this fascinating discussion with Doug McKechnie. So after this interruption, we'll go back.
Congress shall make no law for the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech of the press or the right of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking about Religious Freedom Restoration Acts with Doug McKechnie of the United States Air Force Academy. And what's interesting about this topic is that before you can even understand what a RFRA is, you have to understand the constitutional background. So we've gone all the way back to the late 19th century and a case involving Mormons and plural marriage. The case is called Reynolds versus United States. In the Reynolds case, the United States Supreme Court rejected a First Amendment claim that a practicing Mormon and one who engaged in plural marriage could get an exemption from a law prohibiting bigamy. And thereby, the court established the rule that if you have a neutral law of general applicability, that the government need not grant religious exemptions.
Okay, well, that seems to be a rather commonsensical approach. Certainly, there are going to be people like Mr. Reynolds and like others, perhaps, who from time to time will find themselves rubbing up against the law and feeling somewhat constricted. But at least they can take solace in the fact that they're being treated like everybody else is. Okay, well, so what's the problem? Wasn't that settled as of 1879 then?
Well, interestingly, the court changes its opinion. It changes its opinion about the Free Exercise Clause and what it really means and how it should function with regard to government action. And so if we fast forward about 100 years to the early 1960s, a case comes about, and the case is called Sherbert versus Verner. And in that particular case, a Seventh-day Adventist church member lost her job, and she wanted to get unemployment compensation. She was applying for various jobs, but one of the limitations that her church imposed upon her, her religious belief imposed upon her, was that she couldn't work on Saturdays. And so,
in fact, I think that's one of the central tenets of the Seventh-day Adventists, is that they think the Sabbath falls on Saturday rather than Sunday, right?
That's right. And okay. So she said, when she was applying for jobs, she said, I can't work on Saturday. And the Unemployment Compensation Commission, who's in charge of deciding whether someone can get unemployment compensation, said, well, if you're not going to work on Saturday, that you're kind of disqualifying yourself from work. You're removing yourself from the workforce, and therefore you're not going to get benefits because you're not willing to work on Saturdays.
And she said?
And she said, but I can't work on Saturdays. My religious belief says that I can't work on Saturdays. And so she sued and said that the disqualification for unemployment compensation benefits was a burden on the exercise of her religion.
And so the Supreme Court is faced with a Reynolds-type situation. She doesn't want to go out and marry a bunch of men. That's not what she wants to do. But she wants to get her government benefits without having to violate her religious beliefs by working on a Saturday. So the court simply could have applied Reynolds as the controlling precedent and rejected her claim, but apparently they didn't.
They don't. One could argue that they take Reynolds and flip it on its head and go absolutely the polar opposite of Reynolds. What the Supreme Court says is now that we're in the early 60s, we're going to change our interpretation of the Free Exercise Clause, and we're going to ask the question first, does the government actions, the law, the policy, does the government action impose a substantial burden on a person's religious practice? And is that burden justified by a compelling government interest? So that's a pretty high burden.
That's basically the highest burden there is.
It is. We call that in constitutional law. We call it the strict scrutiny analysis. And, you know,
which is also known as the government loses.
I was going to say, whenever strict scrutiny applies, I'm putting my money on the government losing. It's a rare instance when the government can meet the strict scrutiny analysis. Indeed, it's not just that the government has to prove that it has a compelling government interest. It also has to prove that whatever the regulation is, whatever the action, the law, whatever it may be, it's the least restrictive means to accomplish that compelling government interest. So it's a really difficult burden to prove for the government.
Those are two, we call them the two prongs of strict scrutiny. Now, the first one's hard enough. I mean, it's not just a legitimate government interest. It's not just an important government interest. This is something that's compelling, like saving the lives of children or you know, national security or something. Now, sometimes a government has that compelling interest, but then it has to show that what it's doing is the least restrictive way of doing it. In other words, if the person challenging this law can come up with one alternative, hypothetical alternative, that would somehow be less restrictive in terms of free exercise rights in this case, the government loses. It's basically a perfection standard. And the government, I can only think of a handful of cases where the government has prevailed under strict scrutiny.
Indeed, the Supreme Court will often say when the Supreme Court is analyzing this prong of the test or this part of the test and says, well, you know, is this the least restrictive means to accomplish your goal? Well, did you try this? You know, and the Supreme Court will come up with some, as you mentioned, hypothetical situation or hypothetical way to accomplish the goal. that doesn't burden religion. Did you try this? Did you try this option? And when the Supreme Court starts throwing out options that the government didn't try or didn't explore with regard to trying to accomplish its interest, the government loses.
The government's arguing against infinity. There are an infinite number of choices out there about what the government can do in any given circumstance. And all one person has to come up with one of those infinite choices and say, wouldn't this be a little less restrictive? And so the government loses. So, yeah, you're right. This is a complete 180-degree flip-flop. The government has to grant religious accommodations if something it's doing has any kind of significant burden on a religious practice, which pretty clearly in this case it did.
As one would guess, particularly because we sort of set it up this way, the government always loses when strict scrutiny is applied. The government in the Sherbert case ended up losing. The court said the government failed to show that there was no alternative way to accomplish the goal of trying to make sure that people aren't using religious belief to get unemployment compensation and avoid working. The Supreme Court said there's got to be some other way other than forcing this woman and people like her to work on Saturday, which was against her religious belief.
Now, no disrespect intended to this woman or to the Seventh-day Adventist, but my question is then, why wasn't there an immediate creation of a church, the all-seven-day Adventists, who couldn't work any of the 7 days of the week and who nonetheless wanted unemployment insurance? That would have been a good church to form right then.
That may have been.
Okay, that didn't happen. So what was the next big case that happened under this new approach?
So the next big case would be there are a couple cases throughout the 60s and 70s that are essentially applying this very strict scrutiny. They're applying this Sherbert test. And I think before we get to the next big case in the evolution of the free exercise clause, it's important to note something. And I think what it's important to note is that this strict scrutiny interpretation of the free exercise clause throughout the 60s and 70s and even into the 80s, this application of this test is being used by traditionally liberal courts. And so the Sherbert test, the strict scrutiny interpretation of the free exercise clause, was articulated by the Warren Court.
They were a bunch of liberals.
They were, and I think that some people are surprised to hear that. It's a little counterintuitive to some people that the more traditionally liberal wing of the Supreme Court is being much more protective of the free exercise of religion.
I've always thought perhaps, and you tell me if I'm wrong on this one, I've always thought perhaps it was not so much a specific respect for religion as it was a concern for oppressed minorities. Now, that seems to fit more clearly into the Warren Court's general perspective. Does that seem reasonable to you?
I think so. And I think it's also a heightened protection for liberty generally, liberties generally. So, for example, in 1972, there was a Supreme Court case that talked about Amish and whether or not certain Amish practices could be burdened. And that was Chief Justice Berger and his court. And even though Berger was a conservative, many liberal decisions came out of that court, for example, the Miranda decision and things like that. And those were very sort of liberty-protecting decisions. And so maybe it was this hybrid concern for minorities and also emphasis on civil liberties and protecting civil liberties.
And for a while there, and I'm so glad you pointed that out, because that's right. I think it was Earl Warren, I think, retired in 1969, and he was replaced by Warren Berger, who was a bit more conservative. But there was still a lot of Warren Court hangers-on at that point, so it's still a pretty liberal court. But religious liberty seemed to be an issue about which both conservatives and liberals could coalesce. The liberals might have just been concerned about protecting the little guy and the outsider. I mean, Seventh-day Adventists are a small group, as the Amish are a small group, whereas perhaps a more conservative person would simply be more concerned about protecting religious values.
Right, and it might be one of those situations where liberals and conservatives can come together for different reasons to agree upon the, for example, interpretation of the Constitution.
I think maybe that was what was going on there. Okay, but you've already mentioned, I think, the next big case, the Yoder case, right?
There was a case in the early 70s, and it was a case that came out of Wisconsin, and Wisconsin had a law that required children to go to school until the age of 16. and there was an Amish population in Wisconsin, and they rejected this compulsory education law, particularly for their 14 and 15-year-olds. So they were happy to send their kids to school up until the age of 14, but there came a point in time where they believed that sending their kids to public school would expose their children to the non-Amish influences outside of the Amish community. Their argument, the Amish community's argument, was we have a different sort of educational program. We do a lot of training with regard to manual work and self-reliance, and so to be a part of the Amish community, our children don't really need those last couple years of public school education. Indeed, those last couple years of public school education pose an obstacle to integrating into Amish society.
Indeed, my understanding is that they thought that it was exposing their children to worldly ideas that were leading them away from the faith.
Exactly.
And so they said it's a central, in fact, that we should emphasize that isolation from the world around them is a central practice, if not a central tenet, of the Amish religion. And so this is quite believable. I mean, they are a group of people who, by and large, want to insulate themselves from society. So it's natural to understand, or it's natural that they would think, education only to a certain point, and then from that point on, we want to bring them back into the fold.
And there was virtually no doubt that the Amish way of living and the Amish belief system that they had was part of their religious practice. The court talked about how their claims with regard to the free exercise of their religion were truly rooted in their religion. The Amish way of life was a deeply held religious belief. It had been constant throughout time. This idea of sort of resisting conformity with the modern world was really a fundamental tenet of the Amish faith. And so if by forcing the Amish to send their children to public school past the age of 14, you were really criminally sanctioning them. If they didn't comply with that law, you were criminally sanctioning them for exercising their religion.
And so what was the outcome?
Well, the court said, is this really a compelling government interest? Is it really the least restrictive way to accomplish the goal the government has set out? The court said there's no doubt that governments have the power to require education, and indeed, the Supreme Court said that providing public school and public opportunities to education is a really important function of the state. But in this particular situation, do the Amish students really need those last 2 years of school? The government of Wisconsin wasn't able to come up with any evidence that these last 2 years of public education benefited the Amish students in any significant way, and that the Amish did a perfectly good job, the Supreme Court said, of teaching their 14 and 15-year-old self-sufficiency, all of the skills and traits that one could learn in public school at those ages.
So in other words, the government failed the second prong of strict scrutiny. There was a less restrictive means, and the less restrictive means of achieving the important, actually compelling, government interest in educating children was simply to do it up through the age of 14 rather than the age of 16, and then let the Amish take over.
Yeah, the Supreme Court said, the Amish can do this for themselves at the age of 14 and 15, and so we're not going to require them to enforce this law, because it would really fundamentally change the exercise of their religion.
Okay, so once again, they've shown, the Yoders have shown, there's a substantial burden on their legitimate religious practice. I should just say substantial burden on their practice. The court's notoriously reluctant to say religious practice is legitimate or not. They'll simply say that there's a substantial burden on their religious practice and that they failed the strict scrutiny test. So effectively, between the Sherbert case and the Yoder case, we've got exceptions for Seventh-day Adventists on the Saturday worship, and we've got exceptions for the Amish in terms of public education. So now we've got a fairly well-established new constitutional rule where if you want a religious exception, you can quite possibly get it. So is that the law of the land as of today?
That is not the law of the land as far as the interpretation of the free exercise of the First Amendment is concerned, for the free exercise clause of the First Amendment. And so I think it's important to make that note that While we may talk about laws, for example, the Religious Freedom Restoration Acts that have been in the news, we may talk about those laws. It's important to focus on the fact that the Supreme Court interprets the Free Exercise Clause of the Constitution not in the way that the Sherbert Court did in the 60s, not in the way that the Wisconsin versus Yoder Court did in the early 70s, but there's a new interpretation that came around in the 1990s, and that case was called Employment Division versus Smith.
And we can just skip right to the end. Basically, it's just, let's go back to the Reynolds approach, right?
It did. It was Justice Scalia. Yeah, and again, sort of pointing out that interesting conservative versus liberal interpretation, it's Justice Scalia, who's known to be a conservative on the court, who said, you know, I think we need to go back to the Reynolds interpretation. And Justice Scalia said, so long as a government regulation is valid, neutral, and generally applicable, religious belief cannot trump secular law.
So we've now come 360 degrees. We went toward an approach in Reynolds where the government doesn't have to grant exceptions to neutral, generally applicable laws. We went through Sherbert and Yoder, where the court started granting them, in fact, requiring them effectively with a strict scrutiny standard. And now in the Employment Division versus Smith, we've gone exactly back to where the government no longer has to grant these religious exceptions. And now let's explain why. Let's talk about the facts of the Smith case, shall we?
I think it's an interesting case to talk about, and perhaps it's a perfect case for Justice Scalia to return to the Reynolds case from the late 1800s. The facts of Employment Division versus Smith are that there were Native Americans who were, based on their religious beliefs, required to ingest peyote.
And what's peyote?
Peyote is a psychedelic drug that's derived from natural sources. I think there was no argument or there was no contending the fact that it was a truly held religious belief or part of the religious ritual. It had been around for a long time in Native American religion, and indeed it was vital to the practice of their religion.
And I want to emphasize, when I laugh during this case, as I always do, I mean absolutely no disrespect to the Native American religion or to this particular practice, but you see where I'm heading with this, don't you? If the Native Americans get their exception for peyote, I want to form that new church again, Doug. I think we should form our first church of cocaine.
And I think I mentioned earlier why this was the perfect case for Justice Scalia to return to the Reynolds decision and to return way back to the late 1800s and that interpretation of the Free Exercise Clause, because it's the perfect facts.
Yeah.
Right? Exactly as you just mentioned.
It's the perfect facts.
If the Native Americans can say, you know, this is infringing on our free exercise and we have to be able to ingest peyote, then the concern is that everyone will start coming out of the woodwork and saying, well, I have a new religion. I should be able to ingest cocaine or heroin.
Oh, actually, it's not a new religion. It's a long-held religion. I've held this belief for many years, but I've just been forced underground by these restrictive government drug laws. And finally, I'm coming to the fore, and I'm going to stand up for my long-held, sincerely held religious beliefs. I've been using cocaine for, 35 or 40 years now, but now I want my test case.
Exactly.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I actually don't use cocaine, and I haven't established a church of cocaine. That's just what we call a hypothetical. But we're talking about it in the context of a fascinating discussion with Doug McKechnie, all about religious freedom as reflected in, well, we're about to get to it, things called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. After the break, we'll finish our discussion with Doug McKechnie, and it really is cool, so stick around. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish our discussion with Doug McKechnie of the United States Air Force Academy, all about religious freedom and something called RFRAs, or Religious Freedom Restoration Acts. Before the break, we were talking about the latest and greatest case of the United States Supreme Court on the subject of religious free exercise, Employment Division versus Smith.
Oregon law, which is the state that the Native Americans in the Employment Division versus Smith case, they lived in Oregon, and Oregon law punished the possession of peyote, including possession for religious use. And these gentlemen were fired for ingesting peyote. And just like in the Sherbert case, they went to get their unemployment compensation benefits. They said, we were fired because we were ingesting peyote. And the government said, well, we can't give you unemployment compensation benefits because you were ingesting peyote, and that's against the law.
Exactly. But you skipped over one of the funniest facts in the whole case. What jobs were they fired from?
My recollection is that they worked at a drug rehabilitation.
they were drug abuse counselors.
That's right.
They were, and they got caught on a drug test, and they got fired for using peyote. They wanted their unemployment compensation. They didn't get it, and that's why it's Employment Division versus Smith in this particular case. And so here we have a situation where, rather like polygamy, you've got a social policy that a more conservative member of the court would agree with, right? You're certainly going to be against polygamy, and you're going to be against illicit drug use. And so those are very hard cases to argue that the First Amendment requires exceptions to. Now, contrast that with Verner, which is basically, let's let the Adventists take off Saturday, or the Amish case, where, you know, Yoder case, where, you know, let's just, you know, lower the compulsory education age by a couple of years. This is a much harder case factually, and I've always understood that personally to be why the court did another 180 when it came to the Smith case.
And Justice Scalia said, you know, we've got to return to that late 1800s case, and we've got to return to this idea that when it comes to belief, you can believe whatever you want, but when it comes to conduct, Congress and the states, through their legislative branches and through signing of by the executives of a law, that the government can regulate conduct, and you have an absolute freedom to believe what you want, but once that freedom to believe manifests itself in actions, the government has the right to either regulate and prohibit certain action or require certain action, so long as it's not focused on a particular religion and prohibiting particular conduct because of its religious nature. The government can pass generally applicable neutral laws.
Indeed it can. And I'm going to say, if we stopped right at this point, this would be a great story. It would illustrate so many different things about free exercise of religion and about the Supreme Court itself and about how the court does these 180s over time, all the rest of it. And indeed, this is in some sense a very good stopping point, because this is the law of the land. Employment Division versus Smith, 1990, U.S. Supreme Court. This is the law of the land. But it's not the end of the story, is it?
It's not. So Employment Division versus Smith came out in 1990. Well, it took the federal government 3 years to say that was the worst decision in the history of the Supreme Court.
Which is a bit of an overstatement, but there was a lot of popular resentment, wasn't there?
Well, you rarely see this anymore, but in 1993, the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and sometimes it's referred to as RFRA, was passed by a unanimous House, and only three senators voted against it. And it was signed by President Bill Clinton at that time. So you don't see that very often, and so I was probably being hyperbolic, but that it was a pretty clear rejection of the Employment Division versus Smith interpretation of the Free Exercise Clause. Now, of course, the Congress and the President can't trump the interpretation of the Free Exercise Clause, but what Congress did was it said, going forward from 1993 and on, we're going to impose upon ourselves the old Sherbert strict scrutiny analysis.
So
we're going to say,
so let's pause there.
Sure.
The Supreme Court has basically said in the Smith case, feds, don't worry about these neutral, generally applicable acts. No, you don't have to give anybody an exception for religious reasons. And the federal government says, thank you, Supreme Court. We appreciate that. But guess what? We're going to impose that burden on ourselves. We're going to say, whenever we pass a law from 1993 onward, if somebody wants a religious exemption, if our law has burdened them substantially, we're going to apply that strict scrutiny standard to ourselves voluntarily.
That's right. The federal government said, we have got to come up with a compelling government interest, and that law, whatever law we passed, has got to be the least restrictive way to further our compelling government interest. And so we're going to impose that burden upon ourselves.
Which is really extraordinary. In fact, the first couple times I encountered the RFRA, I thought, what is this? Is this the Congress trying to reverse the Supreme Court? Is this the Congress trying to impose its interpretation of free exercise? And at first I thought to myself, this can't be constitutional. RFRA has got to be an unconstitutional attempt by the Congress to impose its will on the judiciary. And it took me a while to understand what they'd done. They'd simply said, thank you for permission. We're not changing your interpretation of the Constitution, Supreme Court. We're simply voluntarily, statutorily imposing a higher burden on ourselves than is constitutionally mandated. And that's why all of these arguments that we're, I guess, about to get into about state RFRAs are all about statutes. They're not about the Constitution.
And I think that's a really important point, that a lot of people, when they talk about the exercise of religion and whether or not they have a right to do a particular thing because their religion requires it, they often say, well, I have a First Amendment right to do this. I have a right under the Free Exercise Clause of the Constitution to do X, whatever that may be. The reality is the government has a lot of leeway to regulate our actions when it comes to the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment. The government has a lot of power. It's only through the government's own decision to impose a limitation on itself through statute that that we have more protection through, well, statutory protection for our free exercise.
And what these RFRAs are doing are basically they're saying, we liked the approach that the Supreme Court took in the Sherbert Seventh-day Adventist case and the Yoder Amish case, and so we're going to impose that upon ourselves. And so basically they're saying, from this point forward, the federal government's back in the business of granting religious exceptions.
They did. They imposed that burden on themselves, and indeed they tried to impose that burden not only on themselves, the federal government, but they tried to impose that burden on the state government.
Okay, now
well.
This is where it gets too darn complex, Doug. They're for very, very complex reasons, that part of RFRA failed. That part was declared unconstitutional. The federal government couldn't impose that burden on the states, but that means that if a state wants its own RFRA, it can then impose its own RFRA on itself.
That's right.
And go ahead.
Or a state court, theoretically, which has happened, a state Supreme Court could interpret a state constitution to require that strict scrutiny analysis of the state's actions.
Well, I hadn't really thought about that, of course. Yes, you could do that. A state could interpret its own free exercise clause in a way that's consistent with a RFRA. Okay.
Right.
But that brings us now to the present day. So Indiana, among, I think, several other states. How many
states?
Quite a few states, like 30 states or something, has their own state-level RFRA, right?
That's right. There are about 20 states that have statutorily constructed RFRAs, legislative RFRAs, and there are around 11 or 12 states that have interpreted their own state constitution and the free exercise clause of their own state constitution to essentially require strict scrutiny, high burden upon the government, the state government, when it acts to burden the exercise of its citizens' religion.
Okay, so if I live in Indiana and I feel that a state law somehow burdens my religious practice, and I can convince a court that there's a substantial burden to my religious practice, then at that point, the state of Indiana has to satisfy strict scrutiny, which means it's basically going to lose, to statutorily justify that law's application to me. Why is this such an issue today?
Well, one of the things that was in the proposed Indiana RFRA was not just a limitation on the government's ability to limit or burden its citizens' free exercise of their religion, but also to make sure that religious liberty and the free exercise of religion is protected when it comes to a lawsuit between two individuals. And so even if the government's not directly involved, so in other words, I'm not suing the government for its policy that burdens my religion, but I'm suing someone else, when two private entities are in a lawsuit, one of those private entities, even if the government's not involved, can raise RFRA as a defense and say, you can't force me to do something or you can't sue me for something because if you sued me for something that limited my ability to exercise my religion, I can point to our RFRA and that will end the lawsuit.
Oh boy, let me construct a hypo now. It's going to be you and me. Now, do you want to be the conservative Christian or do you want to be the gay guy?
I'm open to either one.
Okay, I'll be the gay guy. You can be the conservative Christian. I walk in, hypothetically, I walk into your bakery and I say, hi, my name's Stuart Harris. I'm gay. I wish to get married to Bill over here. At which point you're the conservative Christian and you say, I'm sorry. I cannot participate in your gay wedding ceremony. I will not serve you. And then I file a lawsuit against you. Now you have a RFRA defense, don't you?
I would have, theoretically in that situation, a RFRA defense. I think it's also important to point out that even before this RFRA issue came up with Indiana, in Indiana there is no protection for homosexuals in the first instance with regard to public accommodations. So technically, I could have discriminated against you anyway. I think a lot of listeners might be surprised to hear that there is no federal law that protects against discrimination when it comes to sexual orientation, and not every state has laws that protect against discrimination.
Well, let's consider that hypo. Let's consider that hypo. Now, sure. Now it's no longer that I'm a gay fellow who wants to get married and you're the baker. It's still that hypo, but now let's move to a different state that actually has an anti-discrimination law.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so I walk in and I say, hi, I would like you to cater my gay wedding. Mm-hmm. And you say, I refuse. And then I go to the state agency in charge of enforcing that anti-discrimination law. And I say, I want you to impose a penalty mm-hmm. on Doug, the Christian baker, because Doug will not serve me. And now the state agency imposes some sort of fine on you.
Or theoretically you could sue for a violation of the discrimination laws in that state, if assuming they protected discrimination against homosexuals. Or think of it in a different way. Imagine that I'm a racist pizza shop owner. And
well, let's stick to religion for just. Excuse me. I know where you're heading with this, but before we leave this, that's what's brought it to the fore.
Right.
Is that we've had this explosion of gay rights. There's been this sea change in at people's attitudes socially, constitutionally, legally, in every respect. Of course, it's not even, but it's this been this huge tidal wave of gay rights legislation and changes in attitude. And that has prompted a reaction. And that's why in my hypo I was mentioning a conservative Christian, because many conservative Christians don't want to participate in gay weddings. And that seems to be the flashpoint issue. And that's why these statutes and these cases are getting such enormous play right now. Okay, but if we were to grant, if we were to follow a RFRA in the state of Indiana or in some other state and grant an exception to the conservative Christian baker and say you don't have to deal with the gay couple. If we were to do that, then we get to your hypothetical, which you were just about to talk about.
Well, one could argue that one's religion requires me not to provide services to really anyone. So, for example, if my religion said I am against interracial marriages because
right.
my religion says that's an abomination or whatever the argument is based on your religious interpretation of your religious text, then theoretically you would be able to raise that as a defense in a lawsuit for discriminating against people because of their race. And to the extent that the government requires you to serve them and not discriminate, that could be a substantial burden on the exercise of your religion. And the government would be subjected to strict scrutiny. And as we've talked about, that's a very, very difficult burden for the government to
meet.
Right.
And as extreme as that sounds, it was not too long ago that Bob Jones University, I think in South Carolina, had a strict policy prohibiting interracial dating. So there are some relatively recent examples of religious beliefs that certainly involve what we most people would perceive as racial discrimination right now. How do you think this is going to play out in Indiana?
There's been a pretty big backlash in Indiana. And I know there's been some talk about trying to incorporate some language into a revised RFRA that would say that the RFRA law is not a license to discriminate. But I'm not quite sure. I think it's going to come down to how discrimination laws are articulated by the legislative branch in the various states that have RFRAs, because I think one could argue and one might be successful that to the extent that any particular form of discrimination is outlawed, that it will not be a RFRA defense to discriminate against someone, because implicitly I think the legislative branch, when they create discrimination laws, is saying we have a compelling government interest to prohibit discrimination. And so I think that would be a good sort of articulation of public policy that a plaintiff could point to and say, well, clearly there's a compelling government interest. Now, where sometimes the government gets tripped up is it the least restrictive means? And that's often, as we talked about earlier, the courts will say, well, did you try this? Did you try some hypothetical situation to accomplish your goal of fill in the blank, perhaps to stopping discrimination? And that, I think, is where there might be some stumbling because of these state RFRAs.
Yeah, and in fact, because of the state RFRAs, it's very difficult to predict any sort of uniform outcome. I mean, there could be 30 or 40 or 50 different outcomes depending on the individual RFRA statutes and depending on the particular claims or the particular complaints that are filed pursuant to each one of them. So it's very difficult to predict how, legally speaking, this issue will resolve itself. What I think is probably more likely, or at least seems to be the case right now, is that there's a political solution that's sort of sweeping the nation. There is, and again, I don't want to predict the future, take sides in this, but you're right. There was a huge national outcry against the Indiana statute, and the Indiana legislature seems to have done a 180 very, very quickly. And other states seem to be hesitating over this as well. And much of the opposition is coming out of the Republican Party, out of the business wing of the Republican Party.
Yeah, and I think your point is right. I think each state is going to have to figure this out for itself. So, for example, in Louisiana and Pennsylvania, they have RFRAs, but their RFRAs do not apply to corporations. And so a corporation wouldn't be able to raise as a defense the fact that its religious exercise was being burdened. It can only be raised as a defense by individuals. And so each state, I think, we think of sometimes states as this laboratory of democracy. I think each state is going to have to struggle with how it's going to interpret and apply its RFRA, and it has to be prepared for, deserved or not, has to be prepared for the political backlash.
It's a real mess. In fact, that doesn't seem to be a very legal term or a very helpful analytical term. But ever since I understood what RFRA does, I thought to myself, oh boy, Congress is just making a mess for itself. It's making a mess because even though it's not technically changing constitutional interpretation by the Supreme Court, it's effectively doing that in this one area. That's mess number one. And mess number two, it's returning to a standard that the court had abandoned because of its problematic nature. And so, the Supreme Court, in a sense, did the federal government a favor in the Smith case. It made life a lot easier for the feds. And then the feds have stepped right back in the middle of it with this idea of RFRA. And now that there's been this proliferation of RFRA statutes, who knows? Who knows, from a doctrinal viewpoint, where ultimately the country's going to end up on this?
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Doug McKechnie of the United States Air Force Academy, who asked me to emphasize again that his opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect any of the opinions of anybody at all in the United States government or anywhere else for that matter. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Chad Barrett. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. Our Madison Minute, which we didn't have today, is by Jim Blaylock, so I'm not going to thank him at all. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.